From KCBW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jeff Robinson, and this is City Views. Like most college students, David Morales has big goals. The 20-year-old Salt Lake Community College student hopes to graduate and continue his education to become a pastor. But for much of the past year, those aspirations have been on hold. In January 2011, Morales was jailed for 17 days because of his immigration status. Morales, like millions of undocumented immigrants, grew up as an American. He came to the country with his parents when he was just 9 years old, but that doesn't change the fact that he doesn't have papers and he's been fighting a deportation order. Today on the program, David Morales joins us to talk about his case and his continuing fight for immigration reform. Plus, avalanche expert Bruce Tremper joins us with advice on avoiding danger in the backcountry. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jeff Robinson, filling in for Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. After more than a year of uncertainty, David Morales finally got some good news last week. A judge closed his case and ruled that he would not be deported after all. It was a huge relief for the 20-year-old college student who came to the U.S. as an undocumented immigrant when he was just 9 years old and was arrested last year while en route to Bible College in Louisiana. But his ordeal only strengthened his resolve to continue to fight for immigration reform. Today on the program, we're talking about his case and immigration reform in Utah and throughout the country. David Morales joins me now in the studio. And David, it's great to have you on the program.
Thank you. And thank you. It's an honor to be here. So thank you.
We're joined on the phone also by Shu Ming Cheer. She's an attorney with the National Immigration Law Center who has been involved with the lawsuit against HB 497, the enforcement-only immigration bill passed by the Utah legislature last year. And Shu Ming, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for the invitation.
And finally, we have Remy Gutierrez with the Salt Lake Dream Team. In 2 weeks, she'll be walking across the country to bring attention to the DREAM Act. Remy, it's good to have you in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Later on in the program, high alert in the higher altitudes, tips on staying safe during avalanche season. But first, David Morales, if you have questions or comments about his case, the DREAM Act, or other immigration reform ideas, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. Or you can send an email to cityviews or at kcbw.org. Well, David, first tell our listeners about how you first came to the United States when you were 9 years old.
My parents brought me to the United States when I was 9 years old. My mom just told us we were going to go to a better place. She didn't tell us, you know, what was going to happen. In fact, in Mexico, you know, they don't tell you once you come here, there's going to be some things that are going to change and you're going to need a social security number and you're going to, you know, the things that we need, like nobody tells us. So for me, it was just kind of like I was just moving to another part of Mexico, even though I knew I was going to another country.
And so did you spend your entire childhood here in Utah, or did you move around a bit, or what exactly?
Like every kid, I don't think they remember anything from like 5 years and younger. Mm-hmm. So I only remember from like five, probably six, seven, eight, nine. So probably 3 to 4 years of memory of Mexico, and everything else has been here in the state of Utah.
What was it like growing up in Utah among your, you know, peers and in class and everything, being an undocumented student? Was it something you talked about, or was it something that your parents told you, you know, you better keep to yourself?
My parents didn't tell me, you know, it's like keep it a secret or anything. Mm-hmm. But it didn't really hit me until I was a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Because I got offered many scholarships. Thanks to my grades, that I was having good grades at my senior year. So I got offered many scholarships, and unfortunately I couldn't take them because of my status.
Shu Ming Cheer with the National Immigration Law Center. Is David's story immigrating to the United States typical of many people that you work with, you know, folks who came here at a young age not realizing that they were coming into, the country undocumented?
Yes, that is very typical, and that's why so many young people have been involved in trying to push for the DREAM Act, which would be a way for young people who came to the U.S. And who finished high school to be able to get their residency. So for all intents and purposes, these people are Americans. They speak English better than their native language. They've been to school here. They're completely acculturated to American society, so we do see many stories like that.
Remy Gutierrez, tell us a little bit about the organization you're involved with and you'll be participating in an activity with in a couple weeks, the Salt Lake Dream Team. How is this organized and come together?
Well, actually, so I am involved with the Salt Lake Dream Team, but mm-hmm. The organization, well, what I'm doing is I'm involved with the Campaign for an American Dream, mm-hmm. and that's the Walk Across America for the Dream Act. And what was the question?
What does the Salt Lake Dream Team do? How have you been involved in advocacy for the Dream Act?
Oh, well, I got involved last year, just early in the summer, after... I just felt like I needed to get involved because the Dream Act failed to pass in 2010. And so being involved, you know, I've been able to do many things, talk to some legislators and just work with some dreamers. You know, I'm an ally mm-hmm. and I have a couple siblings who would be eligible for the Dream Act. So I just... wanted to get involved to fight for them because, you know, they're outstanding individuals and I truly believe that they, you know, they deserve to be given a chance to start a path towards legalization so that they may do the things that they want to do.
You're listening to City Views here on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson, filling in for Jennifer Napier-Pierce. We're talking about the immigration case of David Morales, a 20-year-old undocumented college student who recently learned he would not be deported. You can join us on the air at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, with your questions and comments on the DREAM Act, immigration reform in Utah and across the country, and more. So, David, what happened in January of 2011 while you were traveling to Bible College in Louisiana?
After I graduated high school from Granite Peaks High, that's in South Salt Lake, I wanted to do something with my life where I could help out people. And I always grew up in church, and Jesus has been a big part of my life. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to dedicate my life to him, you know, because after all, he gave his life for me. So I enrolled in a Bible college in Louisiana. I got accepted, and I packed my stuff. I said bye to my friends, my family, and I got enough money to get a plane ticket and pay for the first months of tuition. And so I left here the 1st of January. I left in a Greyhound bus here at the station downtown. Mm-hmm. And after 4 days of traveling through Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, and when I finally got to Louisiana, I was 45 minutes away from the Bible college that I was supposed to study for 2 years, and my bus got pulled over by Border Patrol, and the bus driver only announced 5 minutes before we got pulled over, so we didn't really have a choice. The bus just got pulled over, a K-9 dog walked in, and I guess, you know, for drugs or something, and Border Patrol just came in, and they said, hey, this is Border Patrol, we're here for a checkpoint. If you're a citizen of the U.S., just say yes. If no, say no and tell us where you're from. I really believe that if I was going to Bible college, then it was, you know, part of God's plan for me to be going through all of this. And now that I see the end result, I know that it is his plan. And so when he asked me if I was a citizen of the U.S., I said no. I was honest about it. And he just said, okay. And he walked through the whole bus. And after he was going to get out the bus, he just turns around and looks at me. He's like, hey, you, come here. And I was like, okay. And so he takes me out of the bus, and he started asking me where was I going, with who, how did I get to the U.S., through what border, what part of the border, who brought us in, how much did we pay, and all these types of questions that I really don't know. And I was just honest, you know, I was like, I am going to Bible college. I was here since I was 9 years old, and I just want to, you know, study, become a pastor, and hopefully go back to Utah and start, you know, like a church and ministry. And he, after, you know, like 10 minutes of investigating and making phone calls and all this information, he's like, you know, I like you, but I still have to take you. He's like, put your hands up. And I was like, okay. So he arrested me, and he took me to their office, and he got my fingerprints, he got information, he got pictures, all the information he can get. After, in the office, they had like a cage. It was literally like a cage, like a lion, tiger, circus kind of cage. Mm-hmm. And And there was already 7 people in there. So I was number 8. And they were there since like probably 24 hours ago since I got there. And because there's a van that comes pick them up, but like around 2 p.m. But it only comes like once a day. So if you get arrested like at 3 p.m., you have to wait until the next day to get picked up. And they don't give you food. They don't give you anything. They don't have any, at least snacks or anything. So I was in there, and 2 hours later, the van came to pick me up. And then they took us to the detention center, and they got my fingerprints again. They got information. And then they made us get into the orange jumpsuit, you know, the criminals in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And after I got one phone call to make. I called my house, but nobody answered me, so I left a message, but I know nobody really answers the message, the answering machine. So my family didn't know where I was at until 3 days later after I was arrested.
And so was this the first time that you'd ever had any difficulty with law enforcement because of your undocumented status, or had there been previous times in Utah or elsewhere where there were, you know, tight situations where you were worried you were going to be caught?
No, I've been, pulled over for speeding tickets and stuff like that, but nothing that really, you know, like police officer asked me about my status or anything like that. And when I got arrested, I was really nervous because I thought I was going to get deported right away. I really didn't think I had a chance after I got arrested.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to City Views here on KCBWG. We're talking about the case of David Morales. Shuming Cheer with the National Immigration Law Center. I imagine you hear cases about students like David all the time. Is that the case?
Yes, we do often hear stories of students who get caught up in the immigration enforcement dragnet, whether it's due to a stop by police or it's due to direct enforcement by immigration. And unfortunately, these are often young people who have strong ties to the community, who've been involved with community service, who have strong ties to families. And so they get caught up in the enforcement dragnet also and put into removal proceedings where then they're forced to try to find a way to stay in the U.S.
Is it pretty rare for an undocumented immigrant like David to be detained with no previous criminal background whatsoever, or is that fairly common?
Unfortunately, it's fairly common. Often during immigration raids at work sites or in neighborhoods, anybody could get caught up who has overstayed their visa or is here without status. And often even legal permanent residents who have a criminal conviction can also be caught up. And so immigration will detain them and may or may not release them on bond, depending on the situation. But often the people who do get caught up in the immigration detention system are people with no prior criminal history.
And we'll go back to David's story in just a minute here. But first, Shuming, the National Immigration Law Center is currently involved in the litigation over House Bill 497 here in Utah, the enforcement-only law passed by lawmakers last year. I think recently federal judge Michael Wattups decided he would continue the stay on that law, not allow it to go into effect until we hear more from the U.S. Supreme Court about Senate Bill 1070 in Arizona. Is your worry that, you know, what happened to David is going to happen here in Utah much more commonly if this law is allowed to go into effect, I suppose?
Yes, exactly. That is our concern, that if HB 497 goes into effect, then many people will be stopped by the police and asked about their immigration status based solely on the way they look or maybe the way that they speak English, and that these people may then be put into immigration detention and face deportation from the U.S. So overall, we are very concerned that racial profiling will increase if HB 497 is put into practice.
We're talking about immigration reform in the DREAM Act with David Morales, a young West Valley resident who will not be deported because of a judge's ruling made last week. If you've got questions or comments about the case, give us a call, 801-355-8255, or send us an email at cityviews@kcbw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. You're listening to City Views on KCBW in Salt Lake City. Welcome back to City Views here on KCBWG. I'm Jeff Robinson, filling in for Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking with David Morales, a 20-year-old student at Salt Lake Community College who's become the face of many undocumented immigrants who came to the United States as children. If you'd like to join the conversation, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255 is the phone number, or send email to cityviews@kcbw.org. So, David, while you were in the middle of your deportation case, you decided to become an advocate for the DREAM Act, legislation that was being considered in Congress to grant citizenship to undocumented immigrants who serve in the military or who go to college. Why did you decide to do that, especially being in the middle of a court battle? I imagine that might have made you a little bit nervous, or your family a little nervous.
It definitely made my family nervous, especially my mom. After I was released, after I was detained and I was in there for 17 days, my family paid for $1,000 of bail, and that's how I was able to get out. And the next day I flew back to Utah, and after I did a couple of interviews about my story, my situation, there's a person that works in ICE, and he called my attorney and told them that if I did one more interview, he saw me in the newspaper, he heard me on the radio or something like that, that he would return my $4,000, go pick me up at 3 in the morning, and take whoever was at my house. And that was a threat that they did to me. And so my attorney told me not to say anything, not do any more interviews, just, and I was really scared for my family. You know, I was just on my way to college, I come back, and then now all of a sudden I'm going to lose my whole family when I thought I was just going to lose, you know, like my dreams. And so for 6 months, I didn't say anything. I didn't say a word to anyone. I was just, I did like a couple of presentations in high schools and at the University of Utah. But other than that, I was just, you know, trying to stay away from the press because I didn't want them to get pissed off and go after my family. So it was really, I was really nervous for a while. But after I saw so many injustice going on, so many people get detained, so many petitions that we had to sign, and the more that I got involved in activism or, you know, try to like stay a little bit away from it, but the more I just, there were so many stories and so many people that I know I could help if I just like had courage and if I just stepped out and, you know, had that step of faith and not knowing, you know, like where if I was going to get deported or not, or knowing if I was going to arrest it or lose my whole family or everything that I've known for the past 10 years. But I believe it was worth it to stand up for people that can't and people who won't or people who are too scared to. And if I believe if God put me through this, then God's going to take me out. And he has. So I take this as a time to stand up for people. And that's just, you know, I see it the way that Martin Luther King did. You know, even though he was a pastor and even though he was a preacher and he tried to like help people in his own church and community, he also saw so many injustice and so many things that he said, you know, like I can stand up for people. I can, like, if someone's going to do something, it might as well be me. And that's exactly what, you know, I try to do. I try to like stand up for people. And I don't know where I'm going to end up. You know, I don't know what's going to happen to me the next year or the next 5 years. But for right now, I want to defend the rights of people.
And what has been the impact of your case on your family, your mother, your father, your siblings in West Valley? What's it been like for them? Are they at all in fear of the federal government coming after them right now? Are they doing okay, or what exactly?
I don't live with my family.
Okay.
So yeah, but they were scared for a while. Right now, my mom's more relaxed now that my case is going to get administratively closed. But still, just because your case is administratively closed doesn't mean they're not going to, you know, get it like on, wake up on the wrong side of the bed and say, you know what, let's go after him. And they can just reopen my case and come pick me up any time that they want since I'm already under system.
Listeners, join us on the air at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And Liz, you are on the line from Salt Lake City. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, my question is the immigration is so... you know, it's a big issue. What specific is the DREAM Act? I mean, I have an idea, but I guess for the benefit of the listeners that don't really hear too much, what's the DREAM Act?
Okay, Liz, we appreciate the call. So Liz wants to know exactly what are the specifics of the DREAM Act. Shuming Cheer, do you want to address that? Are you familiar with exactly what this legislation does?
Sure. And so, you know, the DREAM Act has changed a few times because it's been before Congress for almost 10 years now. But basically, it would provide a pathway to legalization for people who came to the U.S. at a young age, who graduated from a high school in the United States and either attend community college or four-year college for at least 2 years or enroll in the military for 2 years. So there's a whole sequence of events that have to take place for somebody to qualify for the DREAM Act. But if they do meet those requirements, then they would be on a path to be able to get their green card and their residency in the U.S.
And while we are on the subject of the DREAM Act, Remy Gutierrez, let's come back to you. How hopeful are you about this legislation being reconsidered in Congress? As you mentioned, it failed, and I know Senator Hatch here in Utah used to be a sponsor of the bill. Now he is adamantly against it, whether or not, you know, it's due to it being an election year. We won't go into that, but what are your thoughts, Remy?
Well, my thoughts are I believe in the DREAM Act, even though it failed to pass in 2010. I feel like there's more of a push for it now more than ever. I mean, it was only off by 5 votes, so I think it will definitely pass sometime soon, hopefully. I know that elections are going on this year, but, you know, just like I said, there's a push for it now more than ever because this piece of legislation, the DREAM Act, it's a no-brainer. You know, and it would help millions of people. There's an estimate of 2 million who would be eligible for the DREAM Act, and so, these are the Dreamers. They grew up here. They pledged the allegiance alongside with me and other Americans. You know, they are American, and you know they deserve it. Because they worked so hard. Because that's what they were told. If they work hard, they would, you know, their dreams would come true. And so, you know, just...
Liz, thank you for the call. Listeners, you can join us 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255 with questions or comments about David Morales and his immigration case or the DREAM Act or any immigration-related issues that you would like to discuss this morning. Well, David, tell me about the decision that was just made by a federal judge last week. What did this judge rule?
The judge didn't have any specific ruling in this situation because last time I went to court, I was like, you need to give me an answer, you know, but last time I went to court, it's really stressing to go through deportation proceedings. So I told the judge, can you either solve my situation or deport me? Because I really can't stand. It's not that I'm going to, you know, die or something, but it's really hard for my family. It's really hard for friends and for myself to go through this thinking every day that I might get deported. So I told Judge Pete if he can give me, you know, an answer. And I was willing to, you know, get arrested at the spot or if he can give me something. And he explained to me that, you know, he can't decide. He can only give the ruling based on the decision of the Utah attorneys and my attorneys. So, therefore, I believe if Justin, Judge Dustin Pede would have, like, if it was up to him, I'm pretty sure he would have helped me more. Because he is, you know, he's a really nice judge. And he explained to me, he gave me, you know, kind of like a second option, even though I was kind of already out of options. So last time I went to court, they said they were gonna probably stop my deportation case, and Judge Pete asked them, you know, how long is it gonna take, and the Utah attorney said it's probably gonna take 3 weeks, and so we agreed that we were gonna wait 3 weeks and hopefully my deportation case would be closed, and it passed almost 3 months and my case didn't get closed, so I was really expecting probably to get deported at this court hearing. And so just 40 minutes before my court hearing, driving on my way to court, my attorney texted me. He said, hey, you don't have to go to court anymore. And I was like, why? And he said, they're going to drop your case. And I was like, you know, like out of the sudden, you know, like out of nowhere, he just texted me. He said, I just got a call from, you know, immigration and they're going to drop your case. You don't need to go to court. And so I called my ISAP officer, which is the lady that comes check on my house, because once you're under deportation proceedings, they put you under like a house arrest kind of thing. And so they give you a phone call to your house and they have your voice recorded so they know if it's you, the one that answers. Then you have to go check into their office and tell them I'm still here, and they have to go check into your house to make sure you're still living there. So I've been going through that house arrest for a year and 2 months now. And so I called her because I hoped she had more information, because my attorney was in court and he couldn't text me or call me.
Mm-hmm.
So she just said, you know, just go to court and find out. And so when I get to court, nobody really had a lot of information about my case. They were just like, oh, you just don't need to go to court, and your case is going to get dropped, and you're going to get more information from your attorney. And it was going to be administratively closed.
And so, Shuming Chir with the National Immigration Law Center, tell us about, you know, the change in the deportation policy we've seen from the Obama administration that affected David's case here.
Yeah, so last year on June 17th, 2011, the administration announced through a series of memos that they would begin to exercise what's called prosecutorial discretion. And so that basically meant that they would focus on what they consider are high priority cases, which are people with criminal convictions or people who pose a threat to national security. And for everybody else who's a low priority, they would start to consider whether or not to close their cases or to not even initiate removal proceedings in the first place. So the implementation of the memos and the whole idea of prosecutorial discretion has been a little bit slow, and it's been a little bit inconsistent across the country. But David is definitely the type of person who would be considered a low priority because he's been in the U.S. for so long. He has very strong community ties. He's never been arrested for a criminal conviction, for a criminal matter. And so we're very pleased that David was one of the cases that was chosen for prosecutorial discretion and that his case was administratively closed. But there's still many hundreds of thousands of people in deportation proceedings still who are either waiting for their cases to be reviewed or have been denied prosecutorial discretion. So there's still a long battle ahead of us to make sure that everybody who should get their cases closed does end up with that result.
We want to go back to the phones now. 801-355-8255 is a number. And Yun Khoi, you are on the line. What's your question or comment about the DREAM Act and about David Morales' case here?
Yes, I'm an immigrant myself. I come from Liberia in West Africa. And I really appreciate the efforts by the federal government with this DREAM Act. However, my concern is that they're just trying to put this before people who are mostly immigrants or generations of immigrants who are already legal citizens that could at least change the dimensions of this coming elections, because I'm very concerned that every time there is election time coming closer, everyone tries to put immigration issues more like it's that priority to have everything straightened up. And that was that's my main question. However, on the other hand, I do understand the fact that America has its laws, and I believe everyone should obey the law. I took 2 years to get my paperwork straightened up before even thinking of being authorized to travel to the U.S. And I know that cannot work in certain regions of the world. Like, for example, in Mexico, people spend 5, 6, 7 years in line. And so if something's going to work on the DREAM Act, I'm concerned that the DREAM Act is still limited. Immigration issues, especially for Latin America, needs to be addressed better. You know, that's my main factor. Question and comment is that they stay too long in line getting their papers straightened up.
All right, Yun.
I believe it's xenophobia.
Yun Khoi, we appreciate the call very much. 801-355-8255 is the number to call. And David, I would imagine beyond the DREAM Act, you also agree that this has to be more comprehensive. It can't stop there.
Yeah, definitely. Right now, you know, when I first started, I was advocating for the DREAM Act. But, the more I got to know families, not just students, and the more, you know, I got out of, like, my little comfort zone, my little box, I found out that there were more, you know, it goes way beyond what I thought it was. And the more I traveled to different states, the more I realized, you know, that this is a big issue. So I just don't want to be an activist for the DREAM Act because that only affects 2 million people. But I want to be an activist for the whole immigration reform, for the whole package, because you know, it's not fair that, you know, if I get to stay in the country and I'm a citizen and I get to achieve my dreams, but my family, yeah, they're still run the risk of getting deported. So I just don't want to be an activist for the DREAM Act. I want to be an activist for the whole immigration reform.
Have you had an opportunity to interact with any state lawmakers here in Utah in the legislature, the ones who are trying to take up immigration reform on the state level? What have your interactions with them been like?
It's really hard to like get a hold of them. Hmm. But right now we have talked about, you know, probably like a Utah DREAM Act, just like something that can help the students here in Utah. But right now it's really difficult to pass pro-immigration laws here in Utah. And, you know, like more anti-immigration laws are being passed. And that's why I joined also, you know, the lawsuit against HB 497 in the state of Utah. Because if that happened to me in Louisiana, getting pulled over just on my way to college, it can happen to anyone here. Getting pulled over just on your way to high school or to to the store or to church. So that's why I decided to join the lawsuit. And so it's really difficult to pass laws that can help immigrants here in the state of Utah, but it's not impossible. So as far as talking to people face-to-face, I haven't really had much. We have just been kind of protesting against Sandstrom. We have seen him, and we went to visit Orrin Hatch last August. And he knew that we were coming, so he had police officers in front of him. He didn't let us talk to him. So, yeah.
Xu Ming, as I mentioned earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court is scheduled to hear arguments in SB 1070 in Arizona, which is very similar to Utah's HB 497, the enforcement immigration law. Are you confident at this point that it's going to be struck down, or is its fate unclear?
It's unclear at this point, but we do feel confident in the arguments against the law, because it's unjust, and also because only the federal government should be able to create laws that regulate immigration. And regardless of what happens with the Supreme Court, we do feel that overall any state laws, such as House Bill 497, which treat a class of people differently from others, is unjust and should also not be allowed to remain on the books.
We want to go to the phones one more time here. Carol is calling from Salt Lake. Carol, what's your question or comment?
My comment is that I moved here from Massachusetts. I was raised in New Hampshire since I was 7 years old. I came to the United States. I'm Korean, and I was adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And lived as a went to school, high school. I went to trade school and all that as an American. And just this year, 2010, because of that new law, I couldn't get my license renewed.
I think is it the Real ID Act you're talking about, maybe?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And so I have to go through immigration and they tell me that even though I was adopted, I was raised as a U.S. I've done everything, the jury duty and all that as an American. I even helped out Obama's campaign in Colorado and all that, and then come to find out that I'm not a citizen and that it's a piece of paper from... My mom was also, she's Korean,
mm-hmm.
and I was born in Korea too, but I came to U.S. through my adopted father, and I'm going through all that, and I still don't have, my license still can be renewed.
Well, Carol, we appreciate your call very much. Xu Ming, this is probably a good question for you. The Real ID Act, I know here in Utah there have been efforts by state lawmakers to actually opt out of Real ID, but how has that particular legislation affected immigrants, both, you know, undocumented and legal immigrants in the United States?
Yeah, the Real ID Act has made it difficult for immigrants in many states across the United States to be able to obtain their driver's licenses, which then as you can guess, and as the caller has illustrated, then creates a whole host of problems in terms of people being able to apply for services or to be able to verify their identity. So in Utah, there is the driving privilege card,
mm-hmm.
But I believe there's recently been a change to that also that's made it also more difficult for people without legal immigration status to be able to even get the driving privilege card.
Well, there's been an effort, I know, to repeal it in the Utah legislature to take it away. David, is that something that you've benefited from, you know, being able to drive and have insurance? How might that impact you or people you know if that were to be repealed, the driver privilege card?
Yeah, I mean, driving, I think everyone, you know, it's a necessity. It's not a privilege, like they say, you know, it's a driving privilege. I think it's a driving necessity, and I need to drive, you know, to get places. And so, you know, if HB 497 was to pass, it would really affect a lot of people who drive, you know, because the driving privilege, it's different color than the real driving license.
Right.
And also, you know, with my arrest in Greyhound, I mean, there's only three states that give driving privilege or driving license to undocumented people, and that is Washington State, the state of Utah, and the state of New Mexico. And, you know, other immigrants who want to travel from state to state, they can't drive because they don't have a driver license. So what do? They get on the bus and they travel. And what does immigration do? They get on the buses and they stop people. So this is all planned out. This is all, you know, business is all money. And so right now I'm working on hearing stories. And also people have stories about people who have been arrested in Greyhounds or if they're going through deportation proceedings since, you know, through Greyhound. I want them to send them their stories to stopgreyhound@gmail.com. And, you know, I want to work with people. I want to be able to help out people because, this, you know, if this happened to me, this can happen to anyone in any state and definitely can happen to anyone here in the state of Utah, if HB 497 was to pass, or if they stop, you know, putting driving, giving us the driving license or driving privilege.
This is City Views on KCBW. I'm Jeff Robinson in for Jennifer Napier Pierce. We have just a few more minutes left with David Morales talking about the case of this 20-year-old undocumented student who recently learned that he will not be deported from the country. Well, David, what's on your plate right now? What are your educational plans, and do you still plan to go to school to become a pastor?
I definitely want to go back to Bible college. Definitely not Louisiana, but I do want to go back to Bible college. You know, it's my calling to become a pastor, and but also, you know, helping people. It's a ministry. I mean, that's what ministry is all about. It's about helping people. It's not about how you look. It's not about, you know, how many awards or whatever, how much money you have, or how many people you have in attendance in church. I believe a ministry is to help out people. You know, we're called to outreach, not to inreach. And so I do want to go back to Bible college. Right now, I'm not attending Salt Lake Community College because since I can't work, I can't pay for it. So right now, I'm just full-time being an activist and getting involved and trying to help out people. And I want to, within the next few months, I want to travel to different states. I want to be able to learn more, help out people, and be an activist for an immigration reform. And I'm going to try to do my best. I'm going to try to do everything that I can that's in my power to pass an immigration reform, bring awareness to it, and get people to act, get people to get involved. Because if you see every revolution or every civil right, like the civil rights movement and the woman and the woman's rights, and every right that has happened here in the country, then it start at the White House. It started with the people, and then it built up to the White House. And so I believe, you know, to the Hispanic community or any immigrant community, whether it's in, you know, from Asia or Africa or Europe or anywhere, you know, they have to stop depending on the government because, you know, if we wait for the government, you know, we have waited 10 years for the government to do something for the Dream Act. And, you know, we have people like Raimi who are standing up and say, you know, we're not going to wait for the government. We're going to do it ourselves. And so I want to invite people to get involved in their communities, to join, you know, dream teams, to join people who advocate for the Dream Act and to call their legislators and, you know, anyone that's pro-immigrant or even anti-immigrant and tell them how this affects their lives.
And David, are there any options for you without the Dream Act towards pursuing legal residency, or is there really no path for you to take here?
Even if the Dream Act was to pass, it says I have to be in college for 2 years,
right?
And I can't be in college for 2 years because I can't pay for it, and I can't pay for it because I can't work, and I can't work because they don't know what to do with me, and they just, you know, stop my case, and they're like, okay, you know, have a good day, and let's pretend it's never happened. So I really don't have an option here. You know, many people say, oh, why don't you just get married? You know, but like that can be an easy way, you know, but I'm not here to do easy things or to take the easy way out. And so I want to fight for an immigration reform, not just because it will be kind of the only way for me, but because it's the only way for 12 million people, and 12 million people who just, you know, came here. And, you know, people say, well, why don't you just wait in line like I did? Well, there is no line. You know, it takes up to 6 years to wait, to wait for a paper back from the government saying, yes, you can come to the country, or no, you can't come to the country. And my parents, they couldn't wait 6 years seeing me. You know, I only ate like two times a day. I really didn't have a nice house. You know, we didn't have a shower. We would like shower outside with buckets with water. And so it was really difficult to, you know, be in Mexico, and people just say, oh, why don't you just wait in line? Well, there is no line, you know. People just have to do what they have to do. And my parents did exactly what, you know, John Q did in that movie, you know, Denzel Washington that played John Q. Yeah, you know, they did something that probably to some people was breaking the law. But, you know, if you see your child starving, if you see him hungry, if you see him sick, what aren't you going to do? What aren't you going to pay to see him happy, to see him healthy? And that's exactly what my parents did. So my parents are not criminals. They wanted the best for me, and they have given me the best.
David Morales, we've been speaking with him about his immigration case recently. A judge decided he will not be deported. David, thank you very much for your time and for joining us here in the studio on City Views. We appreciate it. And thank you to Remy Gutierrez as well. It's good to have you.
Thank you.
And thank you to Xu Ming Chir. She's an attorney for the National Immigration Law Center. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to City Views on KCBW. We will be right back. I'm Jeff Robinson, and you're listening to City Views. The death of a snowboarder last week was the latest fatality attributed to an avalanche, and dangerous conditions remain in the backcountry. Joining me now to talk about staying safe in the backcountry is Bruce Trimper. He's director of the Forest Service Utah Avalanche Center. And Bruce, thanks so much for your time. It's good to have you.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Bruce, tell us about this latest, you know, avalanche fatality that occurred and the underlying reasons for what happened.
Well, it happened outside the Canyons Resort, the backcountry, as we call it. Mm-hmm. So it's an area where there's no avalanche control with explosives. So inside the ski area boundaries, they keep it very, very safe. But outside the ski area boundaries, it's like stepping back into the Stone Age. There's nobody doing any avalanche control with explosives out there. Mm-hmm. So people can go into the backcountry. I mean, it's public land, national forest. It's one of the best deals we've ever gotten as Americans, is our own public land, because we all own it. We can go there anytime we want to. But the flip side is that there's lions and tigers and bears and avalanches. So you need to know what you're doing. So a lot of folks who spend most of their time at the resort, you know, you get kind of habituated that everything is safe. So it's pretty hard to make that mental switch when you go across that line, even though you have to go past the signs and everything, to make that mental switch that things are actually dangerous. So folks do go into the backcountry, and some people do it safely, and some people get into trouble. These folks went into terrain that was a little bit too steep and triggered an avalanche and had unfortunate consequences.
How many avalanche deaths have there been this season so far, then?
There's been 4 deaths.
And is that, how does that compare, you know, the number of injuries and deaths so far to 2011?
We are on average for Utah, 4 is our average, and last year, I believe we had 3. I kind of lose track, all the years blend together, sorry. Mm-hmm.
And so, Bruce, obviously the weather this year has been very unique, you know, with the low amount of precipitation. I'm curious how that affects avalanche conditions. Does it have a noticeable impact, the fact that the precipitation has just been so few and far between?
Yeah, this is an extremely unusual year for Utah. We're about 50% of average right now. And what happens is that thin snow means weak snow. It's just the opposite of what most people think. The less it snows, actually, the more dangerous it is because of what we call temperature gradient metamorphism. So big word alert here. when the snowpack is thin, there's a big temperature gradient or a big difference in temperature in the snowpack, and that metamorphoses all the crystals into weak, sugary crystals that just can't support any weight. And so the whole bottom part of our snowpack, the bottom 2 feet of the snowpack, is just very, very weak snow, and it just can't support too much weight. And then now we have a bunch of heavy, dense snow on top of it. It's kind of like putting a brick on top of a pile of potato chips. So that was the problem that we've had for the last month or so, and now we're getting deep enough snow in the Wasatch Range anyway, so we're starting to get several layers. So some of those shallower layers are breaking out as avalanches like they did last week, and then they step down into deeper weak layers sometimes. So we've seen lots of different kinds of avalanches. In the Uinta Mountains, where the snowpack is still weak, it's still very, very unstable and very fragile. And last few days, it's just been coming apart in the Uintas, just avalanches everywhere. Every time the wind blows there, you get lots and lots of avalanches.
And so do you expect it to get a little bit worse as the season goes on? If precipitation picks up, does that mean more heavy snow burdened on top of this weak snowpack?
Yeah, with these kind of weak layers, I should say, since there's a number of different ones, every time you load it with new weight, it reactivates these weak layers. They can kind of sleep in between the storms sometimes. And then when you load it up with weight, they start avalanching again. And snow is just like people. It doesn't like rapid changes. So anytime you give it a rapid change, especially the addition of weight, then you reactivate the avalanches.
And so there at the Utah Avalanche Center, you do a number of things to warn people about the avalanche danger. How do you measure that? Does it involve going out in the snow with a ruler? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, we do a number of things. All of our staff rotate through the office, and we do field work. So spend about a third of our time doing field work, going out skiing or snowmobiling mm-hmm. around and digging holes in the snow. It's a lot less glamorous than you would think. Yesterday was a good day. Just spent a lot of time digging on fracture lines and holes in the snow. That's what I was doing yesterday. And we're testing the snow, looking at the weak layers, seeing how much additional stress it takes to make them break out. So, and then we go into the office. We rotate through the office as well. The forecaster that's in the office gets in about 4 o'clock in the morning, and all of our products are out by about 8 o'clock in the morning, including our interview here at KCPW every day.
Yes, and the avalanche report you can hear at 8:10 every weekday morning here on KCPW. Have you ever been caught in an avalanche yourself, Bruce? I'm curious.
Yeah, I've been caught a couple times. Most avalanche professionals have a close call once in a while. So luckily I've had a couple of relatively minor close calls. Been buried to my waist once or twice.
And so the ones that are less serious, the ones where, there is a possibility that you can escape, alive and without serious injury, what can you do at that point? Is there something you can do once it's already coming down?
Well, people always say that when the avalanche comes down, what do I do? Well, very, very few people are caught by avalanches that they don't trigger. So the avalanches just don't come down from above without warning. I mean, it's very, very rare. So in 93% of avalanche accidents, they're triggered by the victim or somebody in the victim's party. So that means, just like Pogo said, we've met the enemy and he is us. So we're triggering avalanches. That's actually good because it means that we have a choice. We can stay out of avalanches if we want to.
And so we have just about a minute left here, but what is, the gear that you need to take with you when you go into the backcountry? And do you find most skiers are taking this gear, or are there quite a few who are still not being as careful as they should be?
Well, there's lots of different user groups that use the backcountry, and skiers are just one of them. Snowmobilers are a big group, snowshoers, Boy Scout groups, hikers, hunters, all kinds of people use the backcountry. So the kind of things you should do before you go in the backcountry is, number one, get educated. You can just go to our website, utahavalanchecenter.org, and just go to the education tab and watch the Know Before You Go video, which is very exciting. So that's a good start. And then there's a long list of avalanche classes. Also, anybody that's going to the backcountry should carry basic rescue gear, beacon shovel probes, and then there's a lot of new gear these days. Avalanche airbag packs, they work very well. Avalungs. So, be prepared with equipment and be prepared with education.
We've been speaking with Bruce Trimper. He's director of the Utah Forest Service Avalanche Center, and we've been talking about avalanche danger with a few fatalities seen this ski season so far. And Bruce, thank you very much for joining us for City Views here on KCPW. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I'm Jeff Robinson. I've been filling in for Jennifer Napier-Pierce on the program today. City Views is a production of KCBW News. Thank you to Tamara Kemsley and Katie Sheen Abbott. Jesse Ellis is our technical director, and Ryan Cron composed our theme music. You can check us out online at kcbw.org to continue the discussion. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter as well. Next time on the show, corporate philanthropy and how and why Utah businesses give back. Join us for that conversation tomorrow morning. For City Views, I'm Jeff Robinson. Thanks for joining us.